Go ahead and go. This is being videotaped, so we hope to have this available online. I think with technology it will be immediate, so that's a good thing for you and me, so that I don't have to do this too many more times. My name is Elizabeth Walker, and I'm the urban forester for the city of Kirkland. I've been with the city for almost 4 years. I do work part-time, but I'm pretty much dedicated to the planning department. And I really appreciate you coming and attending this workshop. I think it's really important to have this kind of orientation with this pretty extensive new tree regulations. And as you can see from all the different color handouts over there, that we have prepared quite a bit of information in hopefully palatable bites that will work for all of you. So I'll just go over those right now just so you can have them. Most of these will be really for you to take home and refer to in the future. But starting with the ones on the right, we have put together what's really important for the different types of development activity. So in the salmon color is for single family and duplex development. The lilac is multifamily, commercial, any non-residential activity. The blue is for short plats and subdivisions. And then the next piece is a part of the code that I will be referring to only to show you that this is a critical piece when it comes to discussing variations and working around trees. So you have that to refer to. I just put this handout together, and this is the section of the code that is titled Tree Protection During Development Activity. And it's 95.35.6 in the code. And so that's the text straight out from that section of the code. And then I have attached on the back, this is in draft form. I tried to stamp it draft because we're going to be updating this. This is actually from our transportation standards manual. So, but it does start giving you a visual. They have it at 6 foot high, and I think ours is 4 foot high minimum, and so on. So we'll be providing a more up-to-date graphic for you, and hopefully you'll be able to download that from our website and be able to use them on your plans. I did have two classes before this one, or sessions, whatever we want to call them, for directly for arborists or qualified professionals. And I held the first one in the middle of December, and then the second one was in early January. So I've taken that presentation. Josh was at one of them. But I've taken that presentation now and have modified it to be for this audience, which are developers and builders. So anyway, what I thought would be useful for you is to know which of the arborists did attend those two workshops. So that's what this buff-colored sheet is with their contact information. By giving you this list, we're not endorsing that they know what they're doing, which I'm just telling you that they attended, and I believe all of them are certified arborists. So I believe they meet our definition of qualified professional, but that's what that's all about. And then the last one is the outline of today's presentation, so you can make notes on it or pass it on to your colleagues so maybe they can learn from it and maybe even follow it when they view it online. The way it worked out for me the last two times is that I presented the whole show and then waited at the end for questions. It really helps with the continuity and make sure that I get through the material. So please just hold on to your questions unless it's just really you have to have it answered at that moment, because we get off track and then I never can get back on and finish the thing. I have a whole, you see this is 5 pages out of outline, so I have a lot of material to cover today. So if you could just remember your questions, and we'll have opportunity, hopefully, at the end to answer them. All right? But I will ask. Any questions so far? All right. The restrooms are out there, and I'm planning to have this presentation end at 1 o'clock. Okay? All right. So just to give you a little bit of background about why, how we got to where we are, I was hired about 4 years ago, and one of the first things that I was asked to do was to see what's going on with our canopy cover, because there's a lot of benefits that are associated with a good canopy cover within a community. So we did an analysis, and we saw that there was a loss of canopy within the city of Kirkland, and mainly the activity that's causing that is development. So city council actually gave us a directive that we were to update our tree regulations in the private sector, and also do several other things which we have done, and I can go over those with you at another time. But we, prior to the adoption, we were in over 2 years of public process. We had a tree focus group. We worked with the Planning Commission, City Council, Houghton Community Council, and so on. So we went through all the hoops, and also I've asked for a lot of my arborist colleagues to help me, review and make sure that, what we're doing is appropriate from their point of view. So then we were able to have it adopted, pretty much adopted by the council in November of this last year, with an effective date of January 1, and then that was preceded with adoption by the Houghton Community Council. I don't know if you know that we do have two councils, a community council for Houghton area, which is south of here, southeast part of the city, and they need to vote on zoning code. What is it, Jeremy? Just zoning code, or most code that's presented for the city to see whether it applies, what they want it to apply to their jurisdiction. And they did vote to adopt it in December, and we have the effective date of a month ago. We had three goals in mind when we were developing this. Keep it simple. Basically is to increase the effectiveness of retaining quality trees on developing properties, to maintain and enhance the tree canopy cover, because we saw that that was a loss. So the regulations addresses that not only on developing properties, but on properties that are not related to development or not requesting removal related to development. And then you'll notice that this Chapter 95, it includes required landscaping that we've had the code before, but it desperately needed updating. I guess it's 25 years old, so we also updated that to the current standards. So that's also part of Chapter 95. Some of the new concepts that we have introduced with this new code is that basically for all your purposes and applications, a tree plan is required with any submittal of development activity or for a project. And we'll go over the different tree plans. We also were able to be very specific about the type of information that we need from reports that come with the tree plans that are done by qualified professionals. We also had identified and were clear about the type of review standards that we would be using, and that's actually on that white two-sided sheet for your review. And for some cases, and we'll go over that, we do require a tree density to be met, a minimum tree density. We have also included really good standards for tree protection during construction. And that's included, that's the green sheet. And then we also have had the ability now to require retention of trees that were shown to be retained on a developing site to be retained after the site has been developed. That was a major loophole that we saw. It was pretty frustrating for developers and builders that we make them go through all these hoops to retain trees only to have the owners come around and take two per year as allowed under the older code. And then we have a pretty good penalties and enforcement section, and I'll briefly go over that. So, in the code itself, we have a definition section because there's a lot of terms that we've introduced with this new code. So I'll just go over some of them that I think are pretty important to know before we get into the rest of the discussion. One is a significant tree. We have changed the definition of that. It used to be, for deciduous trees, they're 12 inches. At least they have to be at least 12 inches. And in diameter, and they were measured a foot from the ground. And for conifers, it was 8 inches in diameter, measured a foot from the ground. Well, measuring from the foot from the ground was not industry standard. It's diameter at breast height or 4.5 feet above ground. So we made the measurement there, and we made it 6 inches. It has to be at least 6 inches in diameter, measured from 4.5 feet from the ground, for both conifers and deciduous, for both evergreens and deciduous trees. We made it simpler. We have a definition of specimen tree. That is a tree that is of high quality. It's good to very good to excellent condition, and has no major defects. And so that's like our prime. These are the trees that I think we've decided that they're the most important ones for us to really go to bat when it comes to working around them. And I'll go into that in more detail. I put up tree removal as a definition to know, only for your information, that we have included that if one removes over half of the live crown of a tree, we consider that removal. And that would probably apply more to residents, homeowners that are requesting to do tree removals. And this is the only thing that we are getting close to regulating pruning. So that's how we've tried to deal with that. And then we have a definition of viable tree, which when you look in the code, it's very extensive, very specific. And that is what we're using as our base for the discussion of which trees are really worth talking about when we're looking at developing a site. Oh, and we have also a section of the code for a city forestry count. That is for, I'll probably go into that a little bit, but that's for deposits, for fees, and not for fees, but for penalties. And if we cannot find location on a site to plant supplemental trees that are required, that may be used to pay into the account instead of planting them on another site. And then we also have a section called alternative compliance, which talks about how maybe things like specimen trees or landmark trees could be worth more than just the tree credits that they have based on their size to be considered for meeting a tree density, as well as if someone comes in with a low impact development planting plan, that we might say that could be used in lieu of planting certain number of trees. Those are the kinds of alternative compliance. Okay, the concept I talked about, well, I hadn't talked about tree types, but this is an important thing to keep in mind when we're going to go through the different tree plans. This is so that we can make sure that we have set up or we've determined which trees we're going to really be more stringent about retention and alterations around them than others. And so you'll see that when we're going through the tree plans, we're going to be requesting information from your qualified professional, more or less. And then we determine from that information which ones are type 1, type 2, or type 3 trees. And this is what the criteria are for a type 1 tree. Basically, it's either a landmark tree, which is really just a placeholder in our code for trees that have been designated to be heritage trees or landmark trees, which we don't have a program for that yet, but we put it as a placeholder for future for that future program. A specimen tree, which I just talked about what that would be. Trees that are part of a grove that are extending into the next door property, or we had designated through the probably the short plat or subdivision process that they are to be preserved as a grove, or trees that are on at least a 10% slope. And all those criteria are in the code. For type 2 trees, these are trees that don't fit the type 1 definition, but they are viable trees. And they just might be in a location where we may not be able to call them type 1s, but we would probably try to encourage that they be retained because they are viable. So that's the maybe column. And then type 3, those are ones that either the arborist has said they are not viable due to their health or hazard or whatever, or that they are obviously in the middle of a building footprint, so there's no way to work around them. So we'd like to classify those so we can get them off the table and not worry about them as being part of the picture. Another concept that I wanted to just briefly talk about before we get into the tree plans is this tree density. And as it says, it applies only to new, completely redeveloped single-family or duplex sites, or major single-family and duplex sites, which I'll go into what that means. And it would apply also to new short plats or subdivisions. And this tree density concept is basically after we've figured out which trees are being retained through the, when we look at your development, proposed development, we compare the minimum tree density, which is 30 tree credits per acre, to your site to see how many tree credits minimum you need. And it's only used as a trigger that if you fall below that minimum, supplemental trees will be required to be planted in order to meet it. Okay? And on at least the salmon sheet and the blue sheet, I believe we have the table on the back that shows you how many tree credits based on the size of the tree each tree would be worth. Okay, I wanted to also talk about just what our expectations are for when an arborist is needed and what they would provide for you. So I was just going to go through this pretty quickly. The first one is really more for a homeowner that's requesting to remove a tree that's not related to development. So that's if a tree's hazard or nuisance state is not obvious and they're requesting to remove above the limit for developed sites. But when developing properties have these significant trees or viable trees, actually significant trees in these specified areas, which we'll go into, that's when you'll most likely will be needing an arborist. And then when we figured out that there are some trees that need to be retained, type 1 trees in these specific areas, we'll be wanting their expertise to talk about how to protect them and what are some special instruction to work within their critical root zone. This is kind of an abridged version of the definition of qualified professional. It's pretty long. But basically, a qualified professional must possess and demonstrate the ability to perform tree risk assessments and prescribe appropriate measures necessary for the preservation of trees during land development. So they also have to be, at a minimum, a certified arborist, and that's an arborist certification through the International Society of Arboriculture, which is ISA. They're the only group that really certifies arborists. And what I told the arborist group is that these are the kinds of roles that I see them play. Number one, they are an educator to you. You're going to be hiring them to be the expert. And they need to take that opportunity to educate you about trees and what can and cannot be done about them, with them. Also, they are your expert, just like your wetland specialist, your engineer. They are that role for trees on your property, on your development project, and that they need to be objective. So what I'm asking you is that you need to hire them and let them do their job without telling them what you want as a result of their, you know, their assessments. So they already have clear instructions from us as to what our expectations are when we're going to be receiving a report from them. Okay? So let's go into the tree plants. There are actually 5 tree plants we have, but fortunately for you, we only 3 of them apply to development. Though they are big, they're pretty significant. Tree plan 1 supposedly is the simplest. It's for major and minor single family and duplex, as I mentioned before. Major or minor development, and we'll go into that. Tree plan 2 is for multifamily, commercial, any non-residential type of development activity. And then tree plan 3, as I said, is for short plats, new short plats and subdivisions. So for tree plan 1, single family, how many people do that? How many people would be interested in that? Okay, good. We've now split it into 2 because we saw a need to handle these differently. So we have major development, which is new redevelopment or improvements that are more than 50% of the existing square footage we would consider to be major tree plan 1. For minor, it's basically everything else, which makes it easy. So anything that's less than 50% and it results in site disturbance and impact to a significant tree. With the major, there are certain rules that we apply to them that are a lot more stringent than with the minor. What we say with them, now that you know about tree types, is that the applicant shall retain and protect type 1 trees in all required yards to the maximum extent possible. And the information from your arborist will tell you limits of disturbance in order for us to figure out whether it is possible. They must pursue the development variations described in that on that white two-sided sheet that I provided to you, which has the site development variations or design variations that the planner is allowed to use in order to work around type 1 trees and required yards. Okay? I'm not going to go into detail about what each one of those is, but you have it there for reference. With the tree plan 1 major, the tree density is required to be met, the minimum tree density. So we'll have a tree density calculation with that application. And then we have that maintenance agreement, which says that those trees that are on the final tree plan are to be maintained for 5 years. That's that long-term retention concept. What we're going to be looking for on a major, tree plan 1 major, is an accurate location of the significant trees and their drip lines. At least the diameter size of each of those significant trees, and at least the type. We may or may not require an arborist to come in to help, but we need to find this information first as a minimum. And then another thing that we find out is that oftentimes what you're doing on that property is potentially impacting trees that are adjacent to that property. So we at least want to get that information on the plan. We're not going to require you to retain them or anything like that. We just want to get it on the plan so that at least there's an opportunity for you as the applicant or the city to take note for the adjacent property owner that this might occur and that might impact their tree and that they need to deal with that property owner to property owner. And then assessment of the significant trees in the required yards or for the side yards, generally speaking it would be the 10 feet because we don't know if it's a 15 foot total for majority of the lots. we'll need to know which way we're going to be moving the side yards if there's a tree there, a type 1 tree that needs to be retained. So that's all in the on that sheet, as well as in the code, that those are the things that we need to have. So the only times that we really would need a certified arborist or a qualified professional is that sort of assessment of the significant trees in those areas, the required yard areas, to give us information back.
Real quick question. Type, you mean type 1, type 2, type 3?
Or? Yes. Type 1, type 2, type 3. So that will be something that we will determine after we get some information. And hopefully we can do that as early on in the process for the...
But this is on plans that we submit, so how do we know what to put on there?
That's probably what you'll be hiring an arborist before to give us the information about the viability of the tree. Okay, for minor, we felt that we couldn't go that far with minor development on single family and duplex. So the rules are that we will only encourage significant trees that are viable on the property, and pursue any variations that are in the code, but we cannot require it, even if those trees would be considered type 1 in the side yard or whatnot. We felt with a minor addition, we can only use it as an educational, and most likely I will be going on site, but we do still need accurate locations of the trees so that we can have that sort of discussion about your addition, and if the applicant's interested, we'll see how we can work around those trees. So that's why we would only need general information about the significant trees that are potentially impacted by the addition. And it's just general information. You're not required to hire anybody to do that. And the only thing is that instead of that minimum tree density, just like what we require now for developed sites, you have to have at least 2 trees on the site at the end of the project. So if by needing to remove 1 or 2 trees, they are the last 2 significant trees on the site, we will require supplemental planting. Okay, tree plant 2. This is the one for commercial, multifamily, and any other non-residential activity. I'll get into that. But anyway, this would be for development permit or land surface modification that results in site disturbance and impact to a significant tree. And we actually even make it more specific by saying impact to a significant tree in required yards or areas where there's going to be required landscaping through our required landscaping portion of the code. But the application's a little bit different. These are the things that we are going to be requiring is accurate location of those trees, the significant trees, and their drip lines, and the location of adjacent trees that extend over the property line, just like we do with tree plan 1. And then an assessment of the significant trees in those required yards or areas of required landscaping. Now, if it's an addition, or you're just developing a part of the site, we wouldn't require you to do that for all of the trees, only the trees that are impacted by the development activity. But if it is a new development, we would require it for the whole site. And basically, what we would want to do is pursue those applicable development variations that are in the code in order to retain type 1 trees in those specific areas, the required yards and the required landscaping areas. So that we will be able to require. If for any trees that are being retained, they must be properly protected as with any other tree plan. But the interesting thing is that we're not applying tree density, because we felt with these type of development activities, the required landscaping standards are sufficient enough to meet any sort of trees that we would require on these types of properties. Plus, we acknowledge that they are a high-density development activity. So we rely on the required landscaping for the site to do that. But if we have determined through the process that there are viable trees in these specific areas that can be retained, then they are to be retained and incorporated into the landscape plan for the site. And being incorporated into the landscape plan, they're also included into the landscape maintenance agreement for that project. Okay, on to tree plan 3, and we're doing quite well with time. So, tree plan 3, new short plats and subdivisions. This is the most extensive one. This is requiring a lot more information. But this is to set the stage, as we were talking about before the presentation, is that it's setting the stage for the rest of the development activity that occurs on this particular site. So that's why we feel we need all this information up front. But the good thing is that it can be transferred down to the subsequent activities, such as the land surface modification, lot line alterations, as well as all the building permits that come in. They don't have to have their own tree plan 1. They can just refer to this tree plan 3. So that's why we require a little bit more specific information. So we are asking for requesting to have survey location of all the significant trees on the site. And then we identify in the code exactly what a tree inventory is, but it's basically we need someone out there to number the trees and actually tag them out onto the site as well so that we can all refer to them both in-house and on-site, and do the assessments that just like we've done in other tree plans. So we can start determining the viability of the trees and which trees could be considered type 1, type 2, and type 3. So basically, the information on here, except for the survey, probably should be done by a qualified professional as we define it in the code, which is the certified arborist with the ability to do such work. And they are also to identify the limits of disturbance for those viable trees. And we may be able to talk through as to limiting that sort of information to only the potential ones that are to be part of a required yard or a potential preserved grove. So our vision is that this would be an ongoing discussion with the applicant. So after we get all that information, this is where you as the applicant will then use that information, utilize it when you're showing your proposed development activity. So we'll see your proposed development along with that tree information that you got from the qualified professional. Bring it to the table and let's talk about it. And most likely the best place for that would be in a pre-submittal meeting or whatnot, so we can talk about what would be the potential trees that we would consider type 1 and talk about, is there a way to do lot line alterations or designate preserved groves in order to adjust the rest of the development for that preservation. So we would take that opportunity to actually utilize those variations, those development variations on the white two-sided page that I've given to you. Those would be used by the planner during that discussion to see how we can work around type 1 trees that have been determined both by the qualified professional and then by the city. And then the other thing, as I said, for new subdivisions, we would want to have a tree density calculation at the end after we've determined which trees are being retained and compare that to the minimum tree density to see if you've at least met it. Just to clarify, this tree density calculation on subdivisions, it's done on the entire site. So conceivably, a building, a lot may not have trees, but still the whole site meets a minimum tree density. So that would be probably a benefit of doing it at that level, as opposed to trying to do building lots if you already have had a subdivision through the older code. But that's, I don't want to confuse the issue there. So keep that in mind, because we'll have that density calculation for the whole site. And if you've met it with the existing trees, then we'll just utilize that as we go through the other processes. So like the land surface modification, if we find through that process that more trees need to be removed because we couldn't work around them, then we can just recalculate but we'll do it again for the whole site. So that by the time you have a building lot coming in, whatever tree is on that site, tree or trees are on that site, they are part of the overall plan. And if they need to be removed on that level, that's when we would probably start seeing whether you have fallen below the minimum density for the entire site. So we're going to use that calculation throughout the whole process through the life of the project. But just keep in mind that in the end, we're not going to see everyone have two trees, you know, per lot just to meet a density. It may be a different look, and we hope it will be a different look, because we can have a better ability to work around decent trees with design variations. As I said, this tree plan then is used for the subsequent activities, the land surface modification, and then it's just transferred over to the single family, the building lots. So you don't have to go out and have someone create a tree plan 3. We have all the tree plan 1 for each lot. All the information should be there for us to make those kind of decisions. And then in the end, we will also require that maintenance agreement, so that the trees that are on the final tree plan are going to be protected and retained based on what type they are. That if they're just a tree that's being preserved or planted, then it's a 5-year maintenance agreement. But if they're in a preserved grove, we have them set to be set aside in perpetuity. Okay, so that's it on the tree plans for developing sites. Just wanted to quickly go over what we are requiring for developed sites. So these are sites that already have a building, a structure, a home, that they're just requesting to remove trees. We have, in the distant past, we had an allowance of 5 significant trees per year people could remove without a permit. Then we had an interim ordinance for about almost 3 years where we reduced that down to 2 trees per year, per 12-month period. And we found that through that interim period, that seemed to be working really well. People complied. People even provided tree removal request forms showing us which one or two. So we have decided to make that into permanent code, that it is just 2 significant trees per 12-month period. And it's 12-month, not year period. So it's not like you can remove 2 trees on New Year's Eve and turn around and remove 2 trees on New Year's Day, not calendar year. We've also codified what we've been doing with the interim code, is that people need to show how they meet hazard or nuisance criteria that are set in the code in order to be able to remove those above the limit. And the new thing is though, like I said, for tree plan 1 minor for single families, minor development, we will be looking to make sure they have at least 2 trees by the end of their removal request. So if they're down to requesting to remove the last 1 or 2 of the last 2 trees, we don't say you can't remove them, but if you are going to remove them, you need to plant back. So that we're going to try to strive so that every lot is contributing to the canopy, and hopefully we can maintain the canopy, if not enhance it for the city. And then we have for large wooded sites, such as like in Bridal Trails area, for 35,000 square foot lots that are fit our definition of significantly wooded, we have this option of that they can develop a forest management plan in order to remove more than 2 trees per 12-month period. And that's exactly what this is talking about. It does say that for these certain situations, if you're looking to remove trees in sensitive areas or those nuisance enhancer trees above the limit, we do require you to submit a tree plan 4, and that's on another sheet. You don't have to really worry about that unless you live in the city. And tree plan 5 is the forest management plan. So I kept a couple slides in here that I had used for the presentation for the arborist, so I thought I'd just leave them in here for you so that you can see a little bit more about the details that I was relaying to them that we need to have them provide for you as the client and as the applicant. So the tree inventory, again, was that tree number and measuring the diameter and providing the species of the tree. And when they're assessing the viability of those significant trees, I just said, you know, make sure you use the proper tools and techniques, the methodology that's out there. And, you know, don't forget the soil conditions and the site conditions. That's really important to be included in the report. And again, that's for the arborists or the qualified professionals to do. And I said, you know, I really encourage photos because they really help us try to determine whether we really do need to go out into the site. It's good documentation, and so I encourage them to include those in the report. They're also to identify the limits of disturbance, and this concept is for them to, instead of reacting to what you're presenting as the proposed development and saying yay or nay, you can't save that tree, we want them to actually say, okay, this tree is viable, and in order to keep it viable, this is the absolute closest that you should be working next to this tree. And if you have to work within that area, you may have to do tunneling or use pervious services or that sort of thing. And that's a little bit different than how we've been approaching, how even the arborists have been approaching this sort of assignment. But this is where they're going to try to stay as objective as possible. And that's we do that for a couple reasons. One is that it really is important that the arborist stays as objective so they can give you the right kind of information that can be applied to any type of variations that we might explore with that site. And I have an example in my mind of where they hired an arborist to go out and do a major subdivision and gave him where all the lot lines were going to be, where all the right-of-way was going to be, the stormwater, all that. And he went out and said, okay, this has to go because of this, this has to go because of this, not because the trees were not viable. And then all of a sudden, they totally turned the whole project and changed everything. So they had to go out and rehire this guy then to then look at the trees in relation to their new proposal. And so you're going to be hiring them more than once if you do it that way. So I'm trying to save you guys money. We'll see how that works. And now I can't remember the other reason. I can't remember the other reason, but if anyone can else think about it. But one of the things, too, is that I have no problem if they say, you know what, this tree, this is a huge fir. In fact, this is another example. This is a huge fir that's adjacent to an existing building, an existing home. So the root, you know, your root, like for every inch diameter, should be a foot out. That's a guideline. You can't apply that to a tree that's right next to a structure because they don't grow like that. They go to the path of least resistance, the roots. So sometimes, if someone says, you know, I don't know if this is really going to work out, but what I would like to recommend is that, you know, we wait and see. Maybe there's an ability, so as soon as they do the demolition, we can hand dig, see where the roots are, and determine whether the tree can be retained. I am totally fine with that, and I'd actually prefer that rather than them saying, well, it's 1 inch or 1 foot for every inch diameter, therefore the root zone is this, therefore we can't retain the tree. That's not acceptable to me. So this is what I was trying to tell the arborists about. The tree protection specifications or standards are already in the code. Just want them to support them. And I highly encourage that you put those into just onto the grading plans as we specified that to be, to just use what we have in the code. If you could put those as part of the grading notes and use a version of graphics, hopefully we'll update that graphic for you. That would really make it a lot easier for us to review that plan. I also put out some ideas or some things that might happen that ideally it'd be nice if you could just hire that arborist. They could tell you what you need to know and then be able to walk away from the project. But like we said, we're hoping to have an ongoing discussion with you as the applicant as to what are some options. And maybe we might need to call him back to give us some more, a little bit more information regarding one specific tree. So be aware of that, you know, ideally, again, we'd like to just have them be hired by you once, but they may need to come back for that sort of discussion, as well as supervising any activity that's on the site that is deemed needed to be done in order to protect and retain a tree, a type 1 tree. Okay, penalties and enforcement. Wanted to just point out that that's the last section of Chapter 95. And basically, we have increased the fines. And for pretty much all cases, except for one minor case, we can have the ability to impose a fine of $1,000 per tree for any tree that's been illegally removed. And we have a section in there that talks about restoration, and whether you meant to remove the tree or not, we are and whether or not we impose a penalty, we will always require restoration. And the way we have it set up is based on tree credits. Remember that table that said so many credits based on the size of the tree? That's how many tree credits you'll need to restore back to the site, or pay into the account, or if we can find an off-site option, that could be exercised. But we also included that if it is can be proved that a removal was knowingly and willingly done, i.e. that you as the applicant have been through the tree plan review process, tree plan, and you have a tree plan that's been approved, but still a tree has been removed, that can be considered a knowing and willing act of illegal removal. So we can impose the appraised value of the tree versus just tree credits as the payment. And I don't know if any of you have been familiar with the appraised value of landscape trees, and that's the formula that I would use. But it usually is in the thousands to several thousands per tree. So that has been set up as a disincentive for folks who know the rules and yet think that they can just remove a tree and plant a few trees back. The other thing that we wanted to make sure is that you knew is that we also have the ability to impose a stop work order on a job site if we find that we're not getting this communication's not working with the applicant about that violation. So I know time is money, And you don't want your job site to be shut down, but we have that ability to do so if we need to, if we feel like we're not getting cooperation or compliance. And I think this is pretty much my last two slides. And I was asked by the planning group to bring up a few notes about just how are we dealing with applications now, and especially those that have been like short plats and subdivisions that have been submitted prior to the first of the year. How are we going to handle them? So we talked a little bit about this before the start of the workshop, that for short plats and subdivisions that were submitted, basically the old code applies. They don't have to go back and do a tree plan 3 for that subdivision. So that the old rules apply. When, if that has been done and now they're ready to do the LSM or any other types of activity, there is an option that you can use, still continue to use the tree information that you had with your subdivision application, or that you can provide a tree plan 3 at that time, and it would run for the rest of the project, including the building permits, as I described to you. If you don't want to provide a tree plan 3 for that LSM, then we're going to require a tree plan 1 for every lot that comes in, and we're going to apply that tree density requirement per lot. So there may be an advantage to doing a tree plan 3 up ahead, so that it applies, and you don't have to hire someone continuously, plus the tree density is calculated for the whole site, not for on a per tree basis. Other process comments that I got is that we have those color sheets are our way of trying to tell you what is required for each of the tree plans, and so we'll be using that information as a form of a checklist to make sure that tree plans are completed and they're included in your building permits in order for that whole packet to be considered complete. So we know it's a learning process right now. We're willing to work with you. But if you need information and want to talk to someone about exactly what is required for it, that's what the counter is all about for the single family and duplexes and commercial. So please discuss it with us to make sure that we get complete applications. Maybe one thing I should say, Jeremy, is that for third party review, which is you pay more money to get it a quicker review. If you don't provide all the pieces of the tree plan requirements with that packet, all bets are off for the timing. We need all the information in order to be able to keep to that timeline. So,
are you a division of planning?
I am.
Okay.
I am.
With the tree information, does it go through the same planning person?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Actually, that's one minute. Yeah. If you have a demolition permit that is not in conjunction with the building permit, we still need some tree information about that because we're going to be requiring some sort of retention and protection of those trees that are adjacent to the removal of structures. So we have that on there, on those permit applications, that we need some basic information so that we can make sure that those are protected and they're not allowed to be removed. And then I know that with subdivisions, you do require pre-submittal meetings. We encourage that not only for that, so we can talk about the new requirements for subdivisions and short plats, but I think we are also encouraging pre-submittal meetings for any other big project that you really want to know more about how the regulations apply. That would be the best way to get that information. I hope I haven't spoken out of turn, Jeremy, to promote that. All right, so we've tried to put all this information, all that, every time I make something, I give it to John Regala to put on the website. So if you go to the city website and go to the department's webpage, right in the top middle for now is it says new tree and landscaping requirements. If you just click onto that link there, it'll take you to a whole new page that has all this information. If you even want to look at meeting notes from 2 years ago to see how in the heck we got to where we are, we have all the history there. So this is going to be hopefully the one place to go to get more information about the tree and landscaping regulations. I did put up the middle bullet to say that I, as the urban forester for planning, I am available to talk to your qualified professionals if they have any questions about how to comply with our new regulations and submit and provide a report in products that are going to work for you as the applicant. I am available to work with them. But when it comes to tree issues related to the project as a whole, you needing to talk to somebody in planning, you work with the assigned planner for those issues. I think that's it. Plenty of time for questions.
Just one, on this blue sheet for subdivisions, maintenance measures necessary. You're requiring maintenance measures, maintenance measures. I'm curious, on a site that maybe we don't have any new trees planted, just are you considering imposing maintenance measures for the current and the paying trees?
The maintenance measures are basically for the existing trees that are on the site,
right.
You know, what it needs to be done for them. And the supplemental trees, we probably would coordinate to have those planted post-construction.
Well, so maintenance is only during the construction phase?
Well, most likely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but they're going to be, they need to be maintained for 5 years at least. So, you know, it might be good to have someone give you that information as well. But the maintenance measure is to make sure that, actually it's for during construction and post-construction, because a lot of times people don't understand that if you have a mature tree in a landscape, it's important to know that it's not a good idea to put lawn around it and irrigate around it when you're changing the conditions, and then you're making that tree become a less viable tree.
Just got a report back from Brian. There's a lot of these trees listed as fair and, you know, sort of questionable, or listed as significant. But if they're on their way down, and we just happen to be doing our project right here.
Right.
What we do may or may not, if it may not affect it, but it's still responsible to make sure it stays alive after 5 years.
Well, if they're fair, and they're, he would not make them. You have to look at the definition of viable tree, and that talks about.
Yeah.
Long-term survivability. So it sounds like those would not meet our viability meter.
Okay.
Test. Yes?
A question kind of related to that. I was curious on the retention for the bond you'd have to pay for 5 years. It is a cash deposit bond. Is it somewhat like the public works?
We haven't sorted that out.
You don't know what
Jeremy might. I don't know how we're... A bond for the maintenance?
Well, you're talking about a 5 year. You got to make sure that tree's there in 5 years from the day you close.
Right. I don't think we're going to be collecting a bond on that, but we would just have a maintenance agreement that's recorded with the property with the period expiration.
It would actually then, because that was the next part of my question, once you sell the house, you really don't have any control over what happens.
But if it's recorded, then that should be disclosed as part of their...
It's on title, yeah.
Okay.
Transfer title, right.
Okay.
That's the word.
Right. So then it ends up being the responsibility of the new owner that buys the house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes?
Elizabeth, I've heard anecdotally that there's a requirement to retain an average tree canopy of 40%. But in reading the code and really kind of the purpose and intent section of the code, it seems to me that that really speaks more to kind of the, you know, the community, the overall community at large, and kind of more of the 30,000 foot overview. And I just wanted to make sure that was correct.
That is correct. That he is referring to that, you know, what's the optimal canopy cover average for a community for all the stormwater and air quality benefits. And according to American Forests, that's set at 40%. And when we compared that to what we have here a few years ago, we loosely calculated that we have a 32% canopy cover. So we're not too bad for an urban-suburban site. Community. So that's why one of those goals was to maintain and enhance the canopy, is because we need to get, the council wants us to strive for that 40%. So the regulations are part of that formula. Yeah, it's one of them. Because we're also planting street trees and we're managing parks and planting more trees in parks and doing better management there.
Okay. If I understood you correctly, you had a slide about tree density and said that applied to new redeveloped major single family or duplex projects.
Yes.
Well, basically short flats and flats. Does that not apply to multifamily?
No, it does not, because that would be a tree plan two. And the commercial and multifamily sites and I guess other non-residential, have the required landscaping standards apply to them. And we made the decision not to impose the tree density requirement on top of the required landscaping because we feel that the required landscaping is sufficient. Yes?
On the salmon sheet, I guess, for the single-family duplex, I'm a little confused in terms of the tree plan versus tree plan that's, you know, submitted. It says you can incorporate most of this stuff, the general information on a site plan.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you've got significant trees in the yard, you've got to do the report from the arborist.
Mm-hmm.
Does all that information have to go on the plan, or is it NF-11 submitted additionally? Or what?
The general information...
Can we go ahead? I mean, we now have to do the erosion and storm control on that site plan, mm-hmm. area, or the height calcs, now the tree plan. Can that all just get dumped on to a site plan?
Yes, but the report that's done by the arborist should be attached or included, and then...
On that sheet or in a packet like this?
I think the report, if the arborist gives you a report, let that be a standalone document. If they're making recommendations, like put a fence here, you want to put that on the site plan. We don't have
right.
to transfer all that text out of the report onto a site plan.
Okay.
Good question.
I'll see it when I believe it, boy, because it's, I mean, various things have to be on the plan versus on the, you know, the engineer's report. Some of it can go in 8.5.11, some of it has to be on the plans. It's really confusing. And now if there's details required with the erosion storm control, sometimes the details have to be on the plan, sometimes it's not.
Well, what
it's really nice to have somebody on the website or something that is examples, very specific
yeah.
examples of this is an acceptable major single-family duplex, you know, site plan that has all these things on it and is
mm-hmm.
readable.
Mm-hmm.
We're
yeah.
waiting for one, too.
Yeah.
And as of 2006, as far as I know, we still haven't seen a permit come in with a tree that's had trees on it, has a tree plant. As soon as we get one, a good one, we will
okay.
yeah.
make
yes.
it available and say, here's what this guy did, and it works.
So at this point, we can go ahead and try and lump everything on there. It's still readable.
Right, because the what's important is that you show the location of the trees and numbering them, size, species would be nice to have on there, and then the protection or their status of whether they're to be retained or removed, and then for the ones that are being retained, what was the information from the report that tells you the protection distance, the limits of disturbance and that sort of thing, that should also be on that plan. So as Jeremy said, you'll be transferring information from that report that applies to the site plan to be on the site plan. The limits of disturbance and the fencing, all that detail, best place to put that is on the grading or demolition plan, because that's where that information really needs to be. So the fencing and the protection doesn't necessarily have to be on the main site plan.
It does when you have to include the TESC stuff now. That has to be, I mean, typically that's never included. There often is not a demolition or grading plan for single family.
That's true.
I mean, do we get limits of disturbance for the erosion storm control, separate limits of disturbance for the trees?
No, erosion control, I don't know, but the tree information will be its own thing.
Well, we'll try.
Okay. Did you have a question, sir?
I did. Your tree plan 3 for new subdivisions makes it very explicit that the city is going to determine the tree types. Why is that instead of the arborist that we're hiring to do that?
Because we will set it through the criteria that we have in the code. And we don't want to have them figure that out. They don't have to figure that out. We can figure that out. So we'll be the ones to determine whether it's a specimen tree or it fits the other criteria. If you want to pay for them to do it, you can do that. But the thing will be is that we want to keep it as objective as possible for your qualified professional to just tell us the information about it.
I have had issues with the city tending to golden holmborn, and not with trees in particular, but other related issues. So mm-hmm. I'm a little more hesitant to say, okay, here's the keys to the Porsche. Go ahead and have your way with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't like that idea of this.
Well, they can certainly propose. They can say we recommend this to be a type 1, 2, or 3, but we have the power to say we don't agree.
Yes. Kind of an extension of that question, I guess, is I think the code says the planning official for that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think your last slide says, you know, we're encouraged really to work with the planner that's assigned to the project. So is the planner that's assigned to the project making those decisions, or are they really looking to you? Because then there's sort of an arm's length, you know, situation there in terms of, you know, direct communication.
That's true, but I'm on part of the planning team, and I'm considered a planning official.
Yeah.
So I work with the planner to then work with you, or we are at the table at the same time.
I guess it's my hope that when we get into, you know, this process of going back and forth, and where, you know, you have 150 trees on a site, so you have 150 decisions like that that need to get made, that it doesn't go from, you know, the planner to you to the planner to the applicant, that, you know, that can be a little more direct link there, just so that the process doesn't end up, you know, kind of going on and on and on, because this is the one component of, you know,
clarity.
Well, we're going to have to take it through it to figure out, but I'm confident it's going to be smooth, because I am now a resource that's available, and that review is done in tandem with what's happening with the planner. So let's take it through a couple times and see what comes up of it.
Relating a little bit to Jeff's question, though, a type 3 tree, if I'm not mistaken, can be, it's clearly not viable. The arborist says it's not going to last, or it's in an area that is in the footprint of the
right
development. So it could be a totally healthy specimen tree, but if it's smack dab right where
that's correct
it wants to go, we say it comes out, you say no, it doesn't. I mean,
no, we wouldn't say it doesn't. It wouldn't come out. We wouldn't say that. I mean, if he wants to, if you want your arborist to determine type 3 trees, or any of the types, they can do that.
But the arborist can determine if it's in the footprint or not. That's our call.
That's true.
The proposed development. So
that's true.
This type 3 or definition of the type 3 is a real confusing thing, because it just doesn't make sense for you guys to say that's a type 3 tree.
Because it's in the building footprint?
Yeah.
Why can't we say that? Because you're going to be able to remove them. We're just going to look at the whole plan as it relates to your proposed development and make those determinations. following the criteria that we have set in the code.
Okay.
Yes.
You talked very briefly about nuisance trees. Can you elaborate just a little bit more on that? Maybe come up with an example.
Okay, a nuisance tree is a tree that causes physical damage to property, and we've outlined what different kinds of things, like driveways, foundations, roofs, physical contact with roofs, in which there's no reasonable horticultural, arboricultural practice in which to abate the problem. That's considered a nuisance. It's not a hazard in that it's going to fail onto a structure or a target. So, for instance, if you have a London plane tree or a cherry tree that's right adjacent to the driveway, and it's totally, totally taken out the driveway, and there's no way to reasonably prune the roots and prevent it from re-damaging, then we would consider that a nuisance. Does that?
Yeah. Let me propose an example thing. A lot of times previously you see some of these sites where people have come in and planted a hedge with Douglas fir trees.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got 20 Douglas fir trees right along, you know, and back in the 70s when they planted them, this was cool because they got a little privacy from their neighbor. And
careful, that's great. Called grove.
Well, if you don't watch out, yeah.
Yeah, it's not good. So basically, you've got a hedge out of mm-hmm. Douglas fir. Well, now they're 35, 40, 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Every neighbor within a radius of five houses hates those trees. They clog their gutters. What do you do? Is that a nuisance tree?
All of them? Probably not all of them, but it's hard to know. I mean, Doug firs don't do well when they're shaded out, so if they have a tight grove of
exactly.
Then they probably would not be considered healthy or viable.
Yeah, okay. So it comes back to the arborist then.
Yeah, but the nuisance tree thing, those really don't come into play with development.
No, and I would
but the viability. Right. Okay.
Because you were right. There is no such thing as a nuisance tree in like, for instance, under single-family development or...
Not necessarily, because we just want them to talk about the viability of the tree, and then we compare that to what's happening on the site, what's happening adjacent to the site, and that sort of thing.
But it's possible, though, really, that there could be a nuisance tree...
In the making?
There could be a nuisance tree on a... Say you have a single-family site, and you're redeveloping...
Mm-hmm.
And is it possible that one of the trees on there could be a nuisance tree and you ultimately take that out of the count? Is that possible?
And why would it be a nuisance tree? So give me an example. I can't think of a situation where if you're redeveloping a site, there's no property damage to be damaged by a nuisance tree.
Neighbors.
Well, the neighbors, that's a civil issue. That's an issue between the two neighbors.
Okay.
So if that neighbor says it's breaking up my driveway, then they need to talk amongst themselves and then...
So if you've got two neighbors to talk back and forth, now all of a sudden you don't have anything to do with it?
Unless when they do make the proposal that this is a nuisance tree because this is what's happening on my neighbors, then we would allow it to be removed based on being a nuisance because it's damaging property. But we don't make that argument for or against either one. It has to be sorted out between the two parties.
Okay. One more question kind of related to that. In the right-of-way,
yep.
You don't have a lot of say. You guys own that. Again, many people have planted trees in the cedar right directly underneath the power pole,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. How do you deal with that?
The trees in the rights of way are regulated by a different part of the code. So,
do you have anything to do with those trees?
Not directly. That's Public Works.
Okay, so Public Works ultimately has the authority to say, we're running new utilities through this area right here. We want to remove these trees. They have that authority without consulting.
Remove the trees within the right-of-way or on the property?
Not on the property.
Right-of-way, it's their jurisdiction.
Okay.
Did we have a question over here? No, just stretching.
Actually, can you explain tree density a little bit more? I want to make sure I understand it. Let's take, for example, a single family residence.
Okay. What? Look on the either the blue page. How single family salmon. Do you have a salmon page? Okay, we should have, yes we do. At the bottom of the front page, there's an example. So for a 7,200 square foot lot, what we do is we take that 7,200, divide it by 43,560, which is the square footage for an acre, and then multiply that by 30 for 30 tree credits, and that tells you how many tree credits are required, minimum. For a site. So for a 7,200 square foot site, it's 5 tree credits. And for an 8,500 square foot, it's 6 credits when you take it through that formula.
Okay, so then how does that apply to tree retention? If we calculate, come up and say we have 5 tree credits, what's the implication of that as far as looking at our tree plan?
So what we do is we take your minimum and we add up the trees that you have retained. We've all determined these trees are being retained. We look at the size of them, and let's say you have a 12-inch diameter tree and a 20-inch diameter tree, then that's 8 tree credits. So you've exceeded the minimum, so you don't have to plant. No supplemental planting is required.
After the process, as I understand it, is to identify the tree on a parcel, and we're focusing mainly on the type 1 tree, possibly type 2 trees that are within the setbacks.
The required yards, right.
Okay,
right.
Not looking at the building footprint, we can eliminate those. We're looking at the other areas.
Right.
We're dealing with that. And then if at the end of that, should maybe this lot doesn't have any trees, at the end of that, we're going to be looking at this formula then to determine what needs to be part of the landscaping, or at some point we're going to have to end up after the rebuild with
5. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But if there were trees on the site, they are used to meet it.
Great.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Greg. You have had your hand up.
I've had plenty of time to think about it. Real simply, can you share with us, in protecting a viable tree that's to be saved, 4-foot cyclone fence is acceptable?
Well, let's see. Let's look at here. Look at your green. So, protective barrier is B of the green sheet. Erect and maintain a readily visible temporary protective fencing limits at the limits of disturbance. Fence shall be constructed of chain link and be at least 4 feet high unless other type of fencing is authorized by the planning official. And you'll see that number 2, we are asking for signage on that fencing so people know what that means.
Well, what about wood chips?
That, if it is recommended by the arborist, it's fine. Like down number 6, in addition to the above, the planning official may require the following depth of at least 6 inches with plywood mulch. It's the wood chips down there, A, 6A. Plywood or 6-inch mulch would be your wood chip.
Okay, so that cyclone fence goes at the limits of the trees.
Limits of disturbance that was determined by the arborist.
Not necessarily the drip line.
Exactly. So, it could be more, it could be less. It just depends.
You could ignore this person's question.
Well,
6-foot minimum drip line.
That's why I have a draft, because I'm just showing you that that's what the construction of the fence should look like. But you're right. It should not be like just at the drip line. So that's why I need to update that. That's why I put draft on there. Thought I'd give you something rather than nothing. I guess right away, Public Works is requiring a 6-foot fence. So we'll have to figure out a different graphic for us.
One last question. So when this is submitted and there's conflicts between what the city requires and what is in our tree plan by a certified arborist, what can we expect to be controlling?
When you say that this, could you give me an example?
Oh, let's say that a tree arborist calls for wood chips on all the viable trees.
Instead of fencing?
No, in you know, fencing as well.
That's great. I don't think we'll counter that.
I know, but as you mentioned earlier, you're looking to save us money, and I'm asking about wood chips.
Mm-hmm.
If that would be required, if it were in this and not required by the city. In other words, we need to make certain that our arborists are doing, they aren't working just for the city of Kirkland.
They're not over-engineering everything.
Exactly. So I see in one of these tree plans for another city that we have wood chips, signage that goes on, you know, for every tree plan,
right.
6-foot fence, 5 feet outside the drip line.
Oh, yeah. No, I just was at a site yesterday where if the fencing was at the limits of disturbance, that is okay, but we wanted to protect the rest of the root area.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about putting wood chips between these two trees because that's where the driving and the construction is.
Mm-hmm.
Then I probably would recommend it, if not the arborists recommend that. But I still don't understand how.
They may have recommendations in here, as that gentleman said over there, that could go beyond what the city's required.
True.
And if that's the case, then from our point of view, we're going to be really scrutinizing, well, you know, the city doesn't require, you know, sort of thing. I mean, if we don't mm-hmm. have to put three deadbolts on the front door, we aren't going to do it.
Right, right.
Chips, 6-foot fence, you know.
Right, right. Well, we're bound by our minimum, so
yeah.
So therefore we can't require more.
Yeah. Okay, so that would, the city's minimum would be what would...
That's our standard.
Okay.
That's the standard that the arborist should do. Now,
okay.
If they have a really good argument to use, I would say, you know what, that's another...
I think it was more just boilerplate,
mm-hmm.
and we want to be careful about what's put in there as boilerplate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Wow. Uh-oh. One more minute.
Let's
yes.
More of an interpretation question, I think. If you were doing single-family detached condominiums in a multi-family zone, which path do you go down?
You've got multi.
Okay. He's come up, you know.
Absolutely, and we've tried to anticipate all different combinations.
Real quick, hopefully.
Sure.
Let's say that I think the woman was kind of alluding to this. There's nothing on the site.
Mm-hmm.
Brand new construction,
mm-hmm.
family.
Mm-hmm.
Everything on the orange sheet and all this in the ordinance is retention of existing trees, correct? So you're not required to get 35 credits of new stuff that never was there before.
Yes, you do. The tree density requirement is required.
Wow, that's like 60 small trees.
No.
Five
tree credits, so it'd be five trees, 6 foot tall or 2-inch caliper.
That's a good point of clarity. On the chart, the chart starts with 3 to 5 inch diameter.
That's to give, it just says tree density for existing significant trees, not for any trees. See the top title of that table. It only applies to existing. So what we were doing was trying to give credit. If an applicant wanted to save a 3-inch tree, we wanted to give some credit to that. So that was to be a benefit.
But in order to get our 5 tree credits, we need to put in, as I'm understanding your guidance,
you need to put in
trees that are between 6 and 10 inch.
You need
just low.
If you look at number 6, if the calculated tree density is below the minimum, You've got to indicate the size, type, size, and location of supplemental trees needed to meet the density requirement. Supplemental trees must be at least 6 feet tall, they're conifers, and 2-inch caliper if they're deciduous or broadleaf evergreens. They are worth 1 tree credit each. Larger trees might be worth more. So you got to read number 6. Because the table only applies to existing trees, not to new trees.
So I'll be planting 5 trees on that 7,200-foot lot.
If you have no trees there. Correct. All right, well, thank you very much. Hope this was helpful. And go forth and develop.
I do.